You are a CJSF listener. You are the outsider, the rebellious one, the changemaker, the hopeful dreamer, the truth seeker. And we love that for you. Thanks for making CJSF a part of your life.
Today from the Wings Archives, Debt as Warfare.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Without being radical or overly bold, I will tell you that the Third World War has already started, a silent war, not for that reason any the less sinister. This war is tearing down Brazil, Latin America, and practically all the Third World. Instead of soldiers dying, there are children. Instead of millions of wounded, there are millions of unemployed. Instead of destruction of bridges, there is the tearing down of factories, schools, hospitals, and entire economies. It is a war by the United States against the Latin American continent and the Third World. It is a war over the Third World debt.
Economic analyst Susan George is the author of How the Other Half Dies and A Fate Worse Than Debt. In October of 1987, she was the keynote speaker at a conference organized by women titled An Issue of Life or Debt, held at the University of San Francisco. Susan George.
Now, how did these third world economies get into this bind that they can now be dictated to by the northern powers, by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and by the World Bank? The textbook explanation is, well, the OPEC countries were getting all this money back because of the increased price of oil. They didn't know what to do with it. They deposited in the Western banks. The bankers couldn't get rid of all of this money in the north with businesses and consumer loans. And so the natural place to put it was in the Third World, which also had to import oil at higher prices and therefore was out there ready to borrow. It seemed like a marriage made in heaven. Well, if you make a calculation, you can say that maybe 30% of the debt, between 25 and 30% of the debt, was indeed accumulated to pay for higher oil prices. But that's not all by a long shot. The Latin American countries, during the decade starting in about 1972-73, increased their military spending every year by a factor of 12%. African countries have become much more rapidly militarized over the same decade, and they increased their spending by about 18% a year, starting from a lower level, but still the rate of increase was much faster. So they invested what the Stockholm Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, says is about 20% of the present debt burden in armaments. Now, the thing to remember about armaments is, of course, that they're not creating any jobs, they're not creating any wealth, they are not helping economies to turn over, they are never productive. Contributing heavily to the debt crisis is capital flight. Now, that simply means that the hard currency gets loaned to nations in the south and immediately comes back as deposits in northern banks or in very complicated financial schemes, which the same bankers who have loaned to the third world then organize for their third world clients. The capital flight from Argentina, from Venezuela, from Brazil, from Mexico, from Nigeria, from Zaire, from all of these heavily indebted countries, is certainly equivalent, if not more, than their current debt. The elites in these countries did what they wanted with the hard currency and are now counting on the poor people, who never saw the benefit of any of this, to pay back the debt. Another huge element of the debt crisis is what the Latin Americans like to call pharaonic projects. The pyramids, in this case, are huge dams which displace thousands and thousands of peasants. They're the hotel complexes, the stadia. They are the nuclear plants. One of the best known examples is the nuclear plant in the Philippines, which was built right on top of a volcano and which cost $2 billion. It isn't working, which is probably better because of its location, but it is still costing the Filipino people $500,000 a day, in interest on this plant, which was built by an American firm, and plenty of graft built into that as well for Marcus and his cronies. So you have these huge projects, which are barely more productive than military spending, are not producing any wealth for the country. You have another element, current consumption. In a country like Chile, Pinochet, to keep the upper and middle classes happy, pegged his peso to the dollar, which meant that people could exchange their pesos freely for dollars, and they could buy all the goodies from the United States, and they went on a washing machine and stereo and television binge. And all of these goods flooded into Chile, and every time the peso was inflated, let's say last month you made 100 pesos and this month you're making 120 because of inflation, you got $100 last month and $120 this month. So they kept on buying all these goods. And this has resulted in the highest debt per capita in Latin America. But it has also resulted in one of the highest unemployment rates in Latin America because, of course, the Chilean enterprises could not compete with all these foreign goods flooding in, and companies in Chile bit the dust by the hundreds, and now about 30 to 35% of the entire workforce is unemployed. So, usually when you borrow, you're borrowing for something which is productive, which is invested, which is going to create jobs, which is going to create wealth, goods, and to make the economy expand, and therefore repayment is not a problem. But when you invest everything, or nearly everything, in non-productive pursuits, then it's clear that you're not going to be able to pay back. And that is what happened largely with the third world debt. But I would say that even if the third world countries made some very, very bad judgments about debt, and in some cases some criminal judgments, they are not alone at fault. The bankers were not concerned with investment. They were concerned with mongering money and getting rid of it. These guys were about 25 years old. They had quotas, and they were told that they had to get rid of a certain amount of money every month, or that was the end of them. And their top bosses, people like Walter Wriston, who was then the chairman of Citicorp, said, that's okay. I mean, you get rid of as much money as you possibly can, because it will be paid back. Why? Because, said Walter Wriston, countries do not fail to exist. The bankers were clever enough to write these loans at what are called variable interest rates. That means that you don't know at the beginning, when you sign the contract, what the rate is going to be. That rate is going to be determined by the market. Interest rates are of two kinds: nominal, what it says on the contract, and real. So if you've got an interest rate, say, of 10%, but you've got inflation of 12%, then your real interest rate is minus 2, and you'd be crazy not to borrow. And that was the case very often in the 70s. But in the early 80s, inflation went way down, and interest rates began to climb absolutely astronomically. Every time the interest rate goes up 1 point, that is an extra $2 to $5 billion that Latin America owes. So when countries can no longer pay back their interest, much less the principal on their debt, the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, comes in and says, okay, in order to be able to pay back your debt, you're going to have to do all of the following things. The IMF responds to the desires and the needs of the rich countries, particularly the United States, which has a de facto veto power. The U.S. can veto any important decision at the IMF. So it's really the rich countries that are making policy there. But it's very convenient to have this alibi of the IMF. Well, anyhow, the IMF goes into these countries and it says, in order to be able to pay back your debt, you're going to have to get your financial house in order. The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, all the aid agencies have been telling them for 25 years, produce for world markets, export, earn hard currency, that way you will be able to buy what you need. It's a framework in which all of these countries have been encouraged to link themselves as closely as possible to world markets. There has been very little interest in producing for needs of local people. Well, this is part of the international framework in which all of this debt was encouraged. Countries borrowed to develop their export industries sometimes. Part of the productive, the small amount of debt that was productive was often borrowed for this. Increase your revenues, that translates into export even more. And this might be fine if one or five or even 10 countries were getting this advice. But we've now got dozens of countries that are being told to export. And these countries have quite a limited range of products that they can sell. African countries have extremely limited ranges of raw materials, either agricultural or mineral, and they're in competition with the Latin Americans for some of the same products like coffee or sugar. And then for slightly more sophisticated economies, you've got another limited range of manufactured goods like textiles, apparel, small electronics, that sort of thing. But all of these countries are exporting flat out, and this is a recipe for what? For glut, clearly. And for low prices. The bargain that we got between just 1984, 85, and 86 was $65 billion decrease in what we had to pay for third world raw materials. And that was before the precipitous drop in oil prices. So you see that even if countries do exactly what the IMF tells them to do, it's going to be very, very difficult for them to earn anything like the cash they have to pay back. And meanwhile, in order to do this, they are cutting down their forests, they are mining their soils, mining their minerals. The devastation of third world countries because of this export policy is absolutely tremendous. It's not just that cash crops are now taking up space which used to be devoted to food crops. I have some quotes from Kenya which show that in Kenya there are a whole lot of things that happen when you start planting cash crops. One of them is to ask yourself, well, who controls the money when you sell the cash crops? Lots of these are produced by smallholders, by small peasants. They're given a better price to produce, say, cocoa or tea than they are to produce corn or rice. Well, who gets the money? The husband gets the money. Not the woman. Women only control money from marketed food crops, and they have no say, usually in Africa, over how this money is spent. So here's just one quote from a study that was done by UNICEF. The women complained that family involvement in sugarcane production was hurting more than it was helping. Although the family as a whole contributed labor on the sugar plots, the money earnings were controlled and spent, most of it on beer, by the husband. Well, I'm glad to tell you that women brew the beer in Kenya, and they may get some of their own back that way, but beer also takes a lot of grain, a lot of firewood, a very time-consuming and resource-consuming thing. Well, that's one result of cash crops, which one wouldn't think of. Other results are that women are out of the house, their labor is requisitioned. I think we all realize now that African women work longer hours than most slaves, that they've got to collect firewood and water, that if they are requisitioned also to be producing cash crops, something's got to give. And what usually gives is childcare. And what usually gives is being home in order to feed the children. So it's the older siblings who feed the children. They're hungry too. So the 5 and 6 year olds who are supposed to be feeding the 2 year olds eat it all. The 2 year olds don't get fed. I mean, there's a ripple effect through the whole society when you change an element as important as whether you produce food or cash crops. So that's just one effect of IMF policy. That's the side of increasing income by exports. But the other side of the IMF coin is reduced expenditure. And here we get into truly horrendous effects of the debt crisis.
On Wings, you're listening to French political scientist Susan George speaking in 1987 on how debt functions as warfare. The pattern is still in play today.
I would just like to read you something. The hut is sinking in the mud near the bridge over the River Guaibe in Porto Alegre, Brazil. A woman social worker is welcomed by five children, the oldest about 8 years old. The parents have gone out foraging in the garbage heaps. Noticing how poorly the children look, the social worker asks them whether they have eaten recently. "Yes, miss. Yesterday, mummy made little cakes from wet newspapers." "What? Little cakes from what?" asks the woman. "Mummy takes a sheet of newspaper, makes it into a ball, and soaks it in water, and when it is nice and soft, kneads it into little cakes. We eat them, drink some water, and feel nice and full inside." This is the country where, according to official statistics, 86 million people suffer from malnutrition in one degree or another. That's two-thirds of the population. That's the Brazilian government's own statistics. And this is a country which last year and the year before that remitted $12 billion, $1 billion every month to the IMF instead of devoting that money to the internal situation. Now, I'm not saying that even if they hadn't remitted that money, that those people would have been that much better off, because income distribution in Brazil is so skewed that the top 3% gets about half of the national income. But even so, you cannot even think about having any social programs when you are remitting absolutely everything to the banks. There are a lot of other effects, because the IMF immediately says to a country, you've got to cut your welfare expenditures, you've got to cut back on health, you've got to cut back on education, you've got to cut back on transport, you've got to increase the prices of utilities so people can no longer pay for electricity, people can no longer afford to pay for water, they can't take the bus anymore, they don't have shoes for their children to go to school. The buses don't run anyway because the country can't buy spare parts. The hospitals deteriorate. They don't have any medicine. Now in Latin America, if you're going to be hospitalized, you've got to bring your own syringes, your own bandages, your own sheets. There's nothing in the hospitals, in the public hospitals. In the Dominican Republic, for instance, 12,000 workers of the public sector were sacked from one day to the next. A third of the public school teachers in lower schools in Zaire have also been sacked. The former governor of the Peruvian Central Bank said that in his country, the IMF program would result in an extra 500,000 children dying. That's not some leftist, that's a central bank governor. And indeed, in a country like Peru, where you are already part of an aristocracy if you are earning the minimum wage, because not many people have a job with a real salary. But a minimum wage earner in Peru used to have to work in 1980 17 minutes to buy a kilo of rice. By 1985, the same worker earning a minimum wage would have to work 2 hours and 5 minutes. That's seven times more. Cardinal Arntz, the Archbishop of Sao Paulo, sums this up very well. He says, the huge efforts of the past 2 years resulted in an export surplus of $1 billion a month. That's the $1 billion that Brazil immediately remitted to the banks. Yet this money served only to pay the interest on the debt. It's impossible to go on this way. We have already taken everything the people had to eat, even though two-thirds of them are already going hungry. When we borrowed, interest rates were 4%. They're 8% now, and at one point they went as high as 21%. Even worse, these loans were contracted by the military, mostly for military ends. 40 billion were swallowed by six nuclear plants, none of which is working today. The people are now expected to pay off in low salaries and hunger. But we have already reimbursed the debt once or twice over, considering the interest paid. We must stop giving the blood and the misery of our people to pay the First World. And I think that really says it all. However, when people dare to protest these austerity plans dictated by the IMF on behalf of the creditor countries, if they go out into the streets, if they refuse to pay two or three times more from one day to the next for their basic staple foods, then of course the police are brought out and they're gunned down. This has happened already in several countries. It's happened in the Dominican Republic, in Morocco, in Egypt, in Sudan, in Brazil. So this is a kind of warfare. Clausewitz, who wrote just after the Napoleonic Wars, says, "War is an act of violence whose goal is to force the adversary to do our will." Now, what can you do with debt? You can certainly force that country to keep on exporting at bargain basement prices all of the resources that you need for your industry. You can certainly control the infrastructure of a country. Perhaps you've heard of the new technique championed by John Reed, a chairman of Citicorp, called debt for equity swaps, that a foreign bank and or corporation or corporations can purchase that debt and then use the local currency generated to buy assets in a country. Well, let's take an example in Mexico, where one of the largest petrochemical companies, which was heavily indebted, and so heavily indebted that it went broke, called the Grupo Alfa, was purchased for $900 million. Well, Mexico's debt was reduced by not even 1%. That isn't even going to make a $10 million difference in the interest bill every year. But the foreign investors got an enormous amount of infrastructure in petrochemicals, fertilizer, etc. Foreign investors now own the largest pension managing company in Chile. A lot of automobile companies have invested in Mexican industry, etc., etc. I mean, anything profitable and worth having can be bought up on the cheap. Privatization is the other big buzzword. You know, we're going to buy up all of these things. Let's get the state out of state corporations. That means that the state is going to become, in the Third World, less and less relevant to its own economic planning. You can make the adversary pay for his own oppression. I mean, if you've got an occupying army, you certainly don't want to have to pay for that occupying army. And if you've got a debt crisis, what you do is get the poor to remit to the rich. And that's what they've been doing. Interest rates are rising again. So we've really got the poor financing the rich and financing the deficit in this country and financing the merger mania, etc., that is going on Wall Street. And then you also, when you are conducting war, you want docile elites. One perfectly good example of this is the moment that Oscar Arias announced his peace plan. The Reagan administration put curbs on Costa Rican exports, on coffee and flowers in particular. They stopped economic assistance, which had been voted by the Congress, which was already appropriated but not disbursed. They refused for the first time to intervene with the private banks on Costa Rica's behalf. And because the U.S. refused to intervene and the bank said, okay, no more fresh money, Costa Rica could not get any appointments with the IMF or the World Bank either. Now, that is just one example of how you can prevent people from making challenges to the system. If the U.S. doesn't like the Arias peace plan, ha, we'll see what we can do on the debt front. So it's a very interesting tool. And then finally, I think you can prevent dissent at home. You don't want people turning on their televisions and seeing children being napalmed and dying in front of their eyes. I mean, those of you who were around during the Vietnam War know that the American people did not take kindly to this, and that finally the movement grew so great that the United States could no longer prosecute that war. You don't have that with the debt. This is what I call financial low-intensity conflict, or flick, not lick, low-intensity conflict. You don't want to win. You want to wear out the adversary. With lick, it goes on and on and on. And with flick, which is the French slang word for the cops, and I like it for that reason too, with financial low-intensity conflict, you can wear the adversary down and you can keep on draining the adversary, and you can fine-tune the pain by modifying interest rates. So it works very well, because most people think that the debt is either boring or incomprehensible. Well, let me tell you that, I mean, even if you can't balance your checkbook, and I can barely multiply and divide, you can perfectly well understand the debt crisis. And you can understand that it is neither boring nor incomprehensible, that it is a form of war, and that it is a form of war also against us, against the ordinary citizen in the United States. Because what does it mean when a country in the third world can no longer afford anything except reimbursing the banks? $1 billion in lost exports is 25,000 jobs that disappear. So the year of the Mexican debt crisis, 82 to 83, the Mexican trade with the United States went down by $10 billion. That's 250,000 jobs right there. And usually they're the good jobs, the unionized jobs, the well-paid jobs. So it's a war against the people. It's not a conspiracy. I'm not saying that. I'm saying a lot of interests converge in one direction. That doesn't mean it's a conspiracy. But it is an ideal instrument. It's low intensity for the perpetrator, it's low cost for the perpetrator, and it's low in political opposition at home. We may think in the year 2010 that this period was really a period of illusion in history, when we thought something called decolonization was going on. But not necessarily. Recolonization is taking place. And I think we're going towards an economy, if we allow this to continue, we're going towards a world economy which one can only call an apartheid economy, in which a very thin layer of people on the top are directing everyone on the bottom to do their will. Machiavelli summed this up, all of this, quite well. He said, conquered states can be held by the conqueror in three different ways. The first is to ruin them. The second, for the conqueror to go and reside there in person. And the third is to allow them to continue to live under their own laws, subject to a regular tribute, and to create in them a government of a few who will keep the country friendly to the conqueror. That's pretty good for 1510, huh? Says a lot. So, economic policies are not neutral. They can kill.
At the time that Susan George gave this speech, October of 1987, she was a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington and the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She is the author of How the Other Half Dies and A Fate Worse Than Debt. For Wings, I'm Catherine Davenport.
As of 2023, Susan George is president of the Transnational Institute, a think tank based in Amsterdam that works with social movements. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose works can be found through the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
For the past two decades, CJSF 90.1 FM has been the game-changing radio station people have tuned in to listen, share, discuss, and celebrate. From authors, actors, and entertainers to journalists, business leaders, and sports figures, CJSF has welcomed esteemed guests giving you the best in music, news, and spoken word, undoubtedly changing the sound of community radio since 2003. CJSF, diverse, independent, yours.